Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. You know, a lot of really exciting things happen when junior achievement is part of your kid's education. So we're going to bring in a former educator who's now the leader of junior achievement of Southwest New England to learn how JA is inspiring students and young people to be productive contributors to Connecticut's near future workforce and economy. Then we'll stay with the workforce theme and find out how the clean energy sector is not only providing tons of opportunities for a growing and diverse workforce, but we'll also find out why clean energy is also critical to the state's economy and even plays a part in improving public health. Then we're going to close connecting with History, a unique nonprofit helping folks in Fairfield County show off or learn about styles of architecture, community development, and the events and people that shape these places, all on one-of-a-kind bus tours. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Have you been to the Mat? Waterbury's Matt Tuck Museum is a hidden gem to explore this summer or anytime. Right now through September 3rd, you can view the Matt's latest exhibit, Blurring Boundaries, that traces the extraordinary contributions of the female artists in American Abstract Artists, or AAA, from the founder to today's practicing members. Learn more about this and all the unique and engaging events and activities at the Matt by visiting mattmuseum.org. Well, it's been too long since we caught up with our friends at Junior Achievement, and at this point, we are going to turn our attention from the southwest area of the state up to the rest of Connecticut and bring in our friend Jeremy Race. He's president and CEO of Junior Achievement of Southwestern New England. Jeremy, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
So to orient our listeners, because our stations do broadcast over most of the state, but are kind of thickly concentrated in New Haven and Fairfield County, there are still two JA organizations that are operating here in Connecticut?
Correct, yeah. Our office, we're based in Hartford. We serve all of Connecticut except for Fairfield County. Which obviously, so we include New Haven, but there's another JA area that's headquartered in Bridgeport that runs programs in that part of the state.
Very good. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be heading up this JA division.
Yeah, it's been a long journey, but John, I've been here for 21 years, believe it or not, and been president for, I guess, just wrapping up my eighth year here. So it's, you know, I came in, you know, running programs throughout the state, which was an incredible experience, and got to meet, you know, amazing JA volunteers and educators and funders along the way. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have opportunities kind of along my journey where, you know, I was able to kind of test out other skills. And, you know, after enough years, someone saw some potential, and here I am.
So for folks who may have heard about the organization but aren't exactly sure what Junior Achievement is in 2023, give them a quick orientation as to exactly what you folks are doing.
Sure. No, I mean, there's three kind of main concepts that we teach, and those are financial literacy, work readiness, and entrepreneurship. But what I've always said, John, is what we teach is real life skills. We're teaching young people, you know, primarily, you know, K through 12, although we now are starting to work with the 18 to 25 population, which is exciting as well. But, you know, primarily focus K through 12 and just getting them to understand what's out there. What does success look like? How do they achieve that success? What is the path? And the real power, John, of our programming is, yes, we have great curriculum that teaches these concepts, but the real power of what we do is in our volunteers. We literally have thousands of volunteers from the business community who teach our programs, and those folks really become, you know, mentors. And what I like to say is kind of the inspiration that brings these programs to life.
Now, I have to think it was at least 10, maybe even as much as 15 years ago that I first learned and realized that junior achievement was not something for the high school crowd, but that you had actually successfully began migrating programming into middle and elementary level. So I don't know how carefully people are listening on an early Sunday morning, but how do you achieve the eventual goals that JA wants to do in our state, in our communities, better by beginning programming and familiarity with the organization at kindergarten?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I do get asked that question a lot. I think, you know, and I kind of have an education background, so maybe I'm a little biased, but I'm always a big believer in starting that foundation of these important, you know, kind of economic education concepts as early as possible. That's why that K through five space, that elementary school space, is so critical for us, and why we're so dedicated and committed to maintaining our programming with these elementary schools. Because, you know, John, the reality is, you know, we're teaching kindergartners, first grades, basics, like what is money? How do you use it? What is a job? What does that mean to work hard? What's work ethic? You know, for example, in second grade, we're teaching kids about taxes and, you know, why taxes are important and why people pay taxes. And, you know, third grade, they learn, you know, what's a debit card and how do you manage it? You know, fourth grade, they're actually doing little profit and loss calculations by learning how to start a business. So at that grade level, at those levels, it's basic, but it's important. It's opened these kids' eyes to what's possible. And that's on the curriculum side, John, but I think back to my comments about the volunteer side, what's really, really important is, I'll share a stat with you that's meaningful both at that elementary school level and also the middle high school levels. Is our national organization, you know, JAUSA, has done some great studies, and then they found that 51% of JA students will go into the career or industry of their JA volunteer. So if you think about that for a second, you know, that's why I very humbly have been saying recently that no one does career inspiration better than junior achievement, and I really do mean that.
Yeah, it's like supersizes mentoring to a whole new level, right?
Yeah, I mean, I literally just encountered someone yesterday who works in the bioscience field, and he literally told us that the reason why he's in bioscience is because someone from bioscience came into his JA classroom when he was in elementary school. So that's a local, living Connecticut, New Haven example of someone who kind of proves that stat to be true.
Yeah, the other thing that's really cool is we keep hearing about the challenge to recruit and interest young people in what will be a big chunk of our future job force in the STEM fields. And being able to kind of teach these concepts. I know some people are thinking, oh, third grade, debit card, profit and loss statements, really? But when you, I think, train young receptive kids in a fun way and kind of bring them into math through, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of a more play or playful atmosphere, at least more casual and, you know, kind of non-overlord academic kind of thing, they really stand a much better chance of going on and being successful in math and science throughout their academic career. And as you point out, many of them may end up transitioning into a college and career in those fields.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, there's just so many examples of you know, young people who have literally told us in their own words that the reason why they love JA is because it's fun and it's relevant. And that's what I've always said, you know, kind of made the remark that, you know, schools teach the three R's, JA teaches the fourth one, which is relevancy. You know, it's helping these kids understand when they're learning math and science and other curriculum, how it really ties in and how it's applicable in the real world. And again, we can't underestimate the power of that volunteer, especially, you know, especially when young people see someone that looks like them, John, which is what we're strategically and intentionally, you know, trying to make sure we have the strongest diversity of volunteers as well. That's really, really important for setting that stage for young people to see themselves, doing something really meaningful and successful when they get older.
Yeah. Did you, was your first exposure to JA as a student, or were you first exposed to it as an educator having JA come into your school?
I wish I could say yes to both of those, but the most honest answer is I unfortunately didn't know what junior achievement was until I started working there back in 2002. And then I fell in love, and it's been, like I said, quite a journey since.
Well, being able to lead as an as a former educator must help, you know, when you're trying to crack the nut of a school district whose educators and administrators are all you know, working at or over capacity, to be able to go in and introduce yourself as one of their former peers and really show them the true value of this programming must help, you know, JA of Southwestern New England get into more schools and are able to launch more programs.
Yeah, I think it certainly adds a little credibility, and I think, you know, I think we've got 15 staff, and I think at least three or four others on my team are former educators.
Oh, that's great.
And I think there's a reason, you know, for that, and they've, you know, they've gravitated towards, you know, JA. But I think, you know, you take that and also add in that, you know, we're, especially in the past couple of years, as we're on this transformation of really focusing on impact and making everything we do as meaningful as possible for our students, I think we're doing a better job of listening, John. And when we're talking to, whether it's superintendents, principals, teachers, really asking them questions and finding out, you know, how can we really be a better solution provider for your school, for your students. And I think taking that direction has allowed us to build more meaningful partnerships where educators, you know, truly do see the value.
Well, we know that part of the reason you're here talking about this today is because you have a vision of taking Junior Achievement of Southwest New England in somewhat of a new direction, or you know, expanding on successes to a greater degree. Let's talk a little bit more about your plans for the coming few years and how you are going to create something of a departure for your organization.
Yeah, no, it's an exciting time. As I said to our staff and our board, you know, buckle up because it's going to be quite a ride. But there's just so many incredible opportunities in our future, John, and a couple things happening right now, and then some other kind of more aspirational. But just right now, things are happening that have never happened before. I mean, we now have semester-long programs for high school students in marketing, communications, economics, finance, entrepreneurship. And the curriculum is so amazing, so hats off to our curriculum team at Junior Achievement USA, that colleges and universities are now looking at our curriculum, doing an analysis within their institutions, and they're saying to us that, you know what, if you have high school kids who are taking these semester-long programs and they pass, right, they pass those programs, we will grant them college credit, John. That's huge. That is absolutely huge for all kids, whether they're from, you know, inner city underserved or more kind of urban rural, suburban, affluent, whatever you want to say. You know, it's kind of an equalizer for kids, because that, what we're saying is any student, no matter where you live, can potentially get college credit because you took JA. And by the way, when you're taking a semester-long JA program, it's a huge amount of content and knowledge that you're gaining. So I've already got commitments. Junior Achievement already has commitments from several colleges in state, including University of St. Joseph's, University of Hartford, Albertus. We're in conversations with Central Connecticut State University right now as well. So, you know, this is a real game changer for us, you know, just for this alone, John.
Yeah, and so important because, it wasn't so long ago that the JA hands-on experience, the immersion in JA, kind of ended at high school, and then the young people went out and exercised
utilized everything that they learned and did in JA. Not only giving opportunities to expose older kids to the benefits of JA, you're creating that relationship with higher education institutions, which has got to be good for them, because it may end up attracting some of the seniors who are ready to take their careers and their JA knowledge to the next level, to their institution to study.
Yeah, we use the word continuum. I think, we've typically been a K-12 continuum, and now we can expand that. And, another thing that's somewhat related that's also exciting is, I've been following the news, and there's been numerous, bills that have been presented at the legislative level in Connecticut, calling for a financial literacy mandate. Mm-hmm. Right? Some states already have one. Connecticut does not. And these bills have been presented for years and unfortunately haven't been passed. But it looks like some of these newer bills are gaining traction, and I think it's important, for kids to graduate high school with that financial literacy knowledge. And what I'm, in my conversations with educators is, if this bill becomes whether law or mandate, look no further than junior achievement, because we've got a ton of curriculum that won't cost you a dime. And I think, hopefully that will alleviate some of the concerns that some of the school systems will have. But JA is here. When this mandate comes down, we're here and we're ready. And, I think just another example, John, of how, we can, very aptly meet the needs of our educator partners here.
Well, I think there's a lot of parents and grandparents and educators and people who mentor and love and support kids who may be listening to this segment saying, where do I go? What do I do? How do people learn more about getting a young person that they care about into junior achievement?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways. I mean, at the very basic level, please visit our website at jacon.org, jacon.org. And there's tons of information there. And reach out to us, because, we have opportunities, whether it's reaching out to your child's teachers or principals and saying, hey, do we have this at our school? If not, can we get this at our school? This is important. But we actually also have, John, we have some programs and I'm very proudly say we're the first JA area in the country. There's 101 JA areas in the country. We're the first in Connecticut here to offer programming that parents can actually sign their high school students up for, much like they would sign their kids up for dance or T-ball or baseball or gymnastics.
Like extracurricular, that's great.
Extracurricular. So, and we're first to do it, and we've piloted two or three programs already. So that's another option. If their school is not, bringing JA in yet, let's try to change that. But even if they are, and your child wants an even deeper experience, please let us know.
Fantastic. Great to meet you, Jeremy. And I know we'll be talking again, because it sounds like there'll be a whole new bunch of programs and happenings at Junior Achievement of Southwestern New England, helping kids and young adults connect what they learn in school with life outside of the classroom. Junior Achievement lets these young people know that it's possible to invest in their future, to gain a better understanding of how the world works, and to pursue their dreams. Jeremy Race is the president and CEO of JA of Southwest New England. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on the program. Jeremy, thank you. Well, you may have heard that clean energy contributions to Connecticut's statewide gross regional product have topped $7 billion, and employment growth in Connecticut's clean energy industry as of 2021, it experienced the single highest increase in the past 5 years. So we wanted to find out more, and we went to the 2022 Connecticut Clean Energy Industry Report, which was just released a couple of weeks ago, and a couple of key people tied to it, including one of the folks who helped write it. You heard him on the award-winning For the People a couple of years ago talking about this report when it first was developed. Phil Jordan is back with with us. He's vice president of BW Research, who was charged with maintaining and developing these reports. And we're also pleased to have Brenda Watson on. You folks over the years have heard us doing PSAs and interviews about Operation Fuel. She is their CEO, but she is also tied to this report because she's chair of the Joint Committee of the Energy Efficiency Board at the Connecticut Green Bank. So, Brenda, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So before we get into the industry report, making you put on your other hat, Operation Fuel has been doing critically important work in Connecticut for many, many years. They've certainly been on this program for many years. But a lot of times people think, oh, this is a wintertime, a cold weather issue. Operation Fuel must kind of just, do administrative work in the warm weather. But that is far from true, isn't it?
That is so true. I'm glad you bring that up. And what we're finding is that there is more people seeking assistance in the spring, summer, and fall to keep up with the electric bills. So, yes, we are a year-round program, and we also dabble in energy efficiency. We developed a program called the Better Homes and Buildings Program, which is a barrier to weatherization remediation program. And, we're finding ourselves in the center of this energy transition, which is much in line with this clean energy report.
That's great. Putting people to work within the industries that also provide the kind of core services to your constituents is a great place to be. And I'm thrilled that you're affiliated also with the Green Bank, who's also been a fairly repetitive guest here. Justin May's on the line as well. He's been a great help to this program over the past few years in arranging some of these interviews. So, Justin, shout out to you as well. So, Brenda, the report that was just published a couple of weeks ago and made available to the public and to us to review assessed the industry's impact over the past 5 years. So beyond my brief, speedy introduction, can you give us some background on why the clean energy industry is so important here in Connecticut and a little bit more about its broader impacts on the state's economy?
Yes. The economy, very much so, but also its impact on humans. In 2020, during a devastating time in our public health and economy, you may recall, the clean energy sector accounted for $6.6 billion of Connecticut's gross regional product. And as you noted at the top of the call, it topped $7 billion this year. So where there was a disruption in the sector as a result of the COVID pandemic, it quickly recovered. The challenge during that time and even today is the human element, meaning filling jobs, finding qualified workers. This report is another example of why we need to tap into the systems impacted population, as I imagine many women and men who are returning to their communities haven't been incarcerated want and need to rebuild their lives. The energy sector provides a pathway to careers with no need for formal education. And not only does it aid in decarbonizing our state, we end up building a new generation of climate and community stewards as a result. So anecdotally, I've been hearing way more people make comments like, I'm concerned about my energy use. I want to save more money on energy and things like that. That's not terminology that I recall hearing, 10, 13 years ago when I first started doing this work at Operation Fuel.
Are there a couple of key partner agencies or programs that you can refer to who are helping you out with this, the job recruiting and training for folks, particularly those that may be coming back out of incarceration and, want to make a new life for themselves?
Yes. Organizations like the Greater Bridgeport Community Enterprises, they do recycling of mattresses, and nearly all of their 20 to 30 warehouse employees are second chance individuals. You have energy efficiency vendors who they overlook someone's past for as long as they show motivation and show up for trainings, and find that, you know, that's an untapped resource. That, again, no need for formal education to get into the sector. You know, I think it's also important to recognize that in this transition, some industries in the energy sector will phase out. New technology and industries and energy sources are now being scaled up due to demand, private sector investment, and policy. It's estimated that the Inflation Reduction Act will create up to 1.5 million jobs by 2030 across the U.S. You're talking about 100,000 in manufacturing, 600,000 in construction, 200,000 in the electric sector, and so on. That's according to a recent analysis done by the nonprofit group Energy Futures Initiative. So where are we going to find these people? Because, you know, again, we don't have a human problem. We have a skills problem, and we need to remove barriers to employment and scale up workforce development programs and support energy efficiency vendors who are often small, family-run businesses who, you know, are doing a lot of work, but they also need supports in being able to hire folks and train them.
And that being said, I have to imagine that a proportion of the individuals, no matter where they come from, into the starting level programs for working in the energy sector, do go on to improve themselves and get credentialed or degreed and really, you know, advance into leaders in these fields. It sounds like a fantastic opportunity for all. Brenda, let me give you a quick break, and let's bring Phil on the line here. Phil, we don't need to get into a lot of the background and nuts and bolts in terms of development, because this is a kind of an established report now over the past few years. Is there anything new or different about the 2022 report that you either incorporated in or in terms of the development and delivery versus the prior years?
Yeah, so I first of all, thanks for having me here today.
Sure.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. So the primary, I think, addition to this year was a closer collaboration with the U.S. Department of Energy, really recementing its leadership role in the national version of this report, which is called the U.S. Energy and Employment Report, which then allows Connecticut to do a much greater sort of customization around the details into these important issues that have already been raised by Brenda and in your question. So just a lot more, a tighter collaboration with the Department of Energy. Also allowing us some more detail to focus into some of the, what had been more emerging technologies around things like fuel cells and battery electric vehicles and building electrification beyond some of the more traditional energy efficiency categories and other segments. So just a bit more detail, I would say, this year.
Yeah, and coupling on to what Brenda was already saying in terms of the labor market, has hiring been difficult because a lot of this work is actually, you know, field work and not virtual work?
Hiring has been very, very difficult. It's been steadily difficult, I would say, in Connecticut. This is not an immediately new trend. Nationwide, it's incredibly difficult. There are a number of barriers to employment. There are a number of challenges that exist. And in fact, what we're seeing in many areas of the Northeast is that in addition to some supply chain disruptions that continued throughout the past year as a result of COVID-19, the availability of workforce is very likely now constraining growth, or I should say the lack of availability of workforce is constraining growth in the sector.
Very good. Folks, we're going to take a quick break and come back and dig into some of the key findings on this year's report here. We're chatting with Phil Jordan. He's the vice president of BW Research. He's been with us before talking about this report, and he also helped author it. We also are pleased to have Brenda Watson on. She's CEO of Operation Fuel and the chair of the Joint Committee of the Energy Efficiency Board at Connecticut Green Bank. Stick with us and learn more about some of the key findings in regards to the report. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, you may have heard about it last week on the award-winning For the People, but we're here to remind you the McCall Behavioral Health Network is planning an in-person hiring event on Thursday, June 8th up in Torrington. Candidates will be able to apply, interview, and get hired on the spot. McCall is looking to fill over 10 positions. The event will be held at McCall's main campus at 58 High Street up in Torrington. Candidates can choose to stop by at their convenience at any time between 9 and 1. If you want to learn more, just go to McCallBHN.org. That's McCallBHN.org. We are back. Thanks for sticking with us. We are talking about the latest release of the Connecticut Clean Energy Industry Report. Many signs of positive movement in the energy sector, but as we're hearing, as with so many businesses and initiatives across Connecticut and the nation, one of the key things is filling jobs that are open and available for folks, a number of key jobs, starting level, as we heard from Brenda earlier in the program, don't require specific credentialing or degrees, but certainly could provide a pathway toward a very productive and lucrative career in the industry for those who choose to stay with it. So, Phil, I noticed there were a number of key findings to the report, one of the most interesting being alternate transportation firms. Unprecedented growth between 21 and 22, along with solar. Let's talk a little bit more about those sectors, please.
Sure. So let's start with alternative fuel vehicles. So when we look across the energy mix in the United States broadly and our need to decarbonize the economy writ large, transportation is now the largest source of emissions in the United States, so the internal combustion engine. And so obviously there are a lot of policies and strategies in place to produce alternative fuel vehicles to dramatically lower those emissions. And so we're seeing a couple things happening in Connecticut. The first is an increased adoption of electric vehicles and other alternative fuel vehicles. You know, the commuter economy that exists in Connecticut favors cost savings and performance. And so the popularity of these vehicles is increasing dramatically. And so does their then deployment, the sales and the maintenance and all the other aspects that go with that. Connecticut also has another major strength in alternative fuel vehicles, really around fuel cell, hydrogen fuel cell research. You know, certainly at the University of Connecticut, but also more broadly across the state. Connecticut really a leader in that technology. And so as we look across the excitement around hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells, Connecticut is really well positioned. For solar, it's a little bit of a different example, but also a good one. You know, solar really is the low-hanging fruit for decarbonizing the electric grid. It's the cheapest source of energy in the United States, certainly in the Northeast. It's a mature technology. It's trusted. It's very quickly deployable. It can be deployed in large scale by utilities. It can be purchased by individual consumers and homeowners. So it's just a technology that is very easy to adopt for a lot of different players. It doesn't solve all of the challenges because it's intermittent, right? So you need to couple it with storage because obviously the sun doesn't shine at night. And in our part of the country. It's not the strongest during the winter. So there are certainly challenges with solar, but it is the low-hanging fruit, so it's not surprising that it's seeing the fastest adoption early on. So, you know, I expect that to continue. Solar is going to be a major component of our country's decarbonization strategy and certainly the strategy in Connecticut. So those growth trends are very likely to continue in the coming years.
Very good. And we could refer folks to our podcasts, our For the People podcasts that are located on all of our radio station websites under the podcast tab, because just a few weeks ago, we did an extended episode or segment on the show about the battery storage component of the solar end of things. So if folks want to learn about some breakthroughs there, they can just go and check out that podcast episode. So Brenda, we started talking about inadvertently the diversification of the energy sector workforce with this push to welcome individuals returning from incarceration and taking their second chance and finding a great success to for the most part. But it also appears diversity has been a hallmark of this industry in the past couple of years, and it is growing. Let's talk a little bit more about how the sector is offering entry points into other careers for young people of color and women.
Yeah, I unfortunately it's growing, but I don't think it's growing fast enough. In terms of diversity, so African-American workers increased from 6.3% in 2020 to 6.8% in 21. The proportion of Asian workers grew by 0.2%. Multiracial individuals grew by 0.4%. And the number of women working in clean energy actually declined. And I suspect that that's connected to the shutdown due to COVID, as the COVID pandemic impacted women head of household, women-led households, unfortunately. You know, the sector offers wonderful opportunities for someone with no formal education, as we said earlier, to build a career. I mean, you can work on a single project for your entire career, depending on what the energy innovation is. But we have to ensure that there's a clear and direct pathways for workers of color and women to enter. Investing in workforce development and removing barriers to employment, which could also include increasing our access to public transportation, are critically important in this sector. I mean, someone from Hartford could be very discouraged from seeking a job down in Stanford if it will take them 2 hours to get there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes about 1 hour and 30 minutes to get there by car. So, you know, public transportation would take much longer than that. So I think that, you know, there's definitely a lot of growth in with respect to diversity in the energy sector and the clean jobs sector. But I think that, you know, there's a lot more work to be done to ensure that we are building that workforce out of communities that have been disproportionately impacted by, you know, bad policy. You know, I think that there's definitely a lot of work and energy going towards that.
Also, from a consumer standpoint, clean energy is certainly providing some positive outcomes for small businesses as well as vulnerable communities. Let's talk a little bit about the consumer end of things and what may be available.
Yes, I mean, clean energy can reduce one's overall energy bill. And for a small business, that means investing that money that they would normally use to pay their energy bill to turn it back around and invest in their business. For a homeowner or a person who rents, reducing one's energy burden, improving their indoor air quality means the local community benefits. So that person is now able to pay their rent or mortgage on time, spend that money locally on groceries or other basic needs. And they are that much healthier in their homes. We can actually see a reduction in asthma rates as a result of this transition. We can see healthcare costs go down some as there are, you know, folks who end up in the emergency room as a result of a lack of energy in a home or engaging in behaviors that can cause them some serious health or even worse, in some cases, death as a result of not having energy in a home. So clean energy is often overlooked as a response to community problems. And I'm really proud of this report and being utilized in that way to connect decision makers to this report and understanding that there are so many benefits to ensuring that we make clear and direct pathways into this sector.
Excellent. Phil, we'll give you the last word in the last couple of minutes that we have. As Brenda kind of introduced, and I'd like you to finish up on, when folks hear a program like this, they may get the impression that a report like this Connecticut Clean Energy Industry Report is really kind of like an insider's publication. But what would you say to the average Connecticut resident, taxpayer, business owner about why they might want to click on and download and take a look at these reports as they've been coming out every year?
You know, I know we're here to talk about jobs, but what I want to emphasize is this is about our climate. It's about our community. It's about our built environment. Everyday consumer access to decision making and connecting our returning citizens from incarceration or even the military to jobs. Yes, of course, but to also encourage that they weigh in on energy planning, policy and decisions to be encouraged to join boards and committees or commissions to push their locally elected officials to act on removing barriers to clean energy jobs. And in some cases, there aren't many barriers, but the ones that exist are significant enough. So this report is critically important to the sector. It's important to communities. And it's definitely a read, something that folks should read. I've sent it to many people who have read it on a plane or on a train ride, and they come back and they go, wow, this is really incredible. I want to learn more. So I want to thank the Green Bank and the folks at BW Research for working on this.
Very good. Phil Jordan with us, VP of BW Research, and Brenda Watson, who's CEO of Operation Fuel and the chair of the Joint Committee of the Energy Efficiency Board at the Connecticut Green Bank. This report, the 2022 Connecticut Clean Energy Industry Report, is available now. Phil, what's the easiest place for people to go to click on and get the information?
Yeah, you can head right over to the Connecticut Green Bank website at ctgreenbank.com.
I want to thank you both for the great conversation today, and hopefully you'll see the phone lines and emails and interest in these programs and jobs and energy savings start to come in as a result of this very informative conversation. Thanks for tuning in and being with us this morning. So as we review the hundreds and hundreds of emails that come in to the award-winning For the People every week, a few weeks ago, I was interested to learn about a brand new nonprofit that is operating in Connecticut and helping to entertain and educate folks by providing a history experience, and that is with a T-O-U-R-Y. That's right. We're here with Allison Casaza. She is a tour production manager for History, H-I-S-T-O-U-R-Y, and they connect you to your past by creating tours in places that may be familiar to you because you drive by them or through them at 20 or 40 or 60 miles miles an hour every day, but you never really stop to think what kind of historical magic and points of interest reside there. So, Allison, thanks for joining us and giving us the lowdown on this organization. Appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So beyond the introduction, what are the basic few things that are most important for people to know about your organization?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, our aim is to connect people with these historic places with the goal of promoting their appreciation and their preservation. We operate primarily in Fairfield County, Connecticut, Westchester County, New York as well, and other parts of Connecticut.
So we know you were in you had recent tours in Stamford and Stratford. As you're beginning to explore new ideas and opportunities to expose folks to who come to your organization out of curiosity or because they have a specific interest in learning more about particular towns and cities, how do you kind of put these tours together? What kind of research goes into the background to do the work you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, first and foremost, we need to investigate, research what historic buildings are in any given community, figure out where specifically they are, get some information about their histories, the people that live there, when they were built, any other important events or people that have lived there, beyond when it was built. And then it comes down to crafting a tour that has a lot of great content in it. And, making sure logistical things. We do primarily bus tours, and we do have some walking tours. But with the bus tours, we have to make sure that we can, navigate to all these places. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these old roads can be a little bit tricky. But from start to finish, we utilize a lot of resources that the states have put out, that the historical societies have, and we'll also, utilize literature as well.
So the upside to taking advantage of history is that you create kind of in some way, shape, or form a thematic continuity. It's not just going to one museum or going to one site or going to one historical society. Some of these tours involve multiple stops, right?
Oh yes, absolutely. For example, a bus tour, we will drive by between 20 and 25 buildings, and along the way, as we're passing by, we'll point out details about their architecture, and we'll also discuss their histories. And then we do coordinate several stops where the tour guests will get off the bus and we will tour interiors. This could be sometimes museums, but primarily we'll work with homeowners. So people get a really unique opportunity to see historic homes.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Up close.
Yeah. What is the proportion of locations on your tours that people might not otherwise be able to ever access or see versus sites that are fully or partially publicly accessible?
Sure. I would say it's 75% or
wow.
Upwards.
That's great.
Yeah. Yep.
So, how do you identify and isolate? And then, this sounds like a lot of really important and interesting work, but the phone call or the knock on the door to the next candidate location, that could be flattering to a property owner, but how do you talk them through it, or how do you learn more about which of these locations might be of particular interest to the folks who come on your tours?
Yeah, well, we're looking for places that have that retain the historic detail. You know, obviously, when we're talking about a colonial home, you're not going to get something that looks 100% as it did back then. But, you know, we do want to have a certain amount of those historic features visible inside the home. Mm-hmm. And then you're correct. It is an undertaking to find contact information people and to do all of that outreach. But it's definitely worth it. And we think that it's something that the tour guests, you know, enjoy the most out of the tours.
Hmm. And, you know, I imagine that in some instances when an individual with a very unique site or home says yes, you know, for this one time, then that might be the only chance that folks might ever get to see some of these beautiful locations. But while at the same time, I have to think that there's also some really good standbys that you try to utilize any time you're bringing a tour to a particular region or city.
Yeah, well, to that end, all of our tours are what we call one and done. So we're not going to repeat the same content over and over again. So really what we're asking for the homeowners is just to, you know, open up their homes on one particular day.
Mm.
And also, you know, this isn't an open house style. As I mentioned, it's a bus tour, so it's coordinated, and we spend about 20 minutes to a half an hour at each home. But yeah, it's really exciting for people to be able to see these spaces. And also it's neat to see, you know, house museums are certainly great and valuable, but it's also very interesting to see, you know, how people are living their modern lives in these historic homes. It's a neat blend.
Mm. Tours like this are most valuable when they are led by very engaged and educated guides. Let's talk a little bit about your team.
Sure. Well, we are continuing to develop our network of tour guides. We look for people that are either particularly knowledgeable in the local history, so perhaps they're affiliated with the local historical society, or they're the town historian, as we've had lead our Reading tour. Mm. We also look for people who have, you know, perhaps backgrounds in architecture, as our tours kind of straddle both the architecture and the history. You know, that leads us to looking for people that have backgrounds in either of those areas.
Mm-hmm. And for folks that like a little bit more personal freedom or flexibility, you can also help them, too. I see that you arrange self-guided and driving and walking audio tours. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Those are still in development, but we do have almost a dozen between Fairfield County and Westchester. So the self-guided tours utilize an app. And so we put into that app all of the, you know, geographical coordinates for these locations. And as people are driving by or walking by, the audio content will automatically play. And it's very much, you know, the same type of idea where we're discussing architecture as well as the histories of those places. And so those are really neat, as you mentioned, for people, you know, who want to have some freedom and you know, schedule these on their own time. Each of those are about an hour and a half in length. And so, yeah, it's a really great way to experience what we do if you can't make it to one of our tours or both.
So then in the last couple of minutes that we have, the only thing left to talk about is what's in store for the summer and fall with Histori. What can folks take advantage of, and what are some of the cool things they might be able to see if they book with you in June, July, or perhaps on into the later summer, early fall?
Sure. Well, we decided that the summer, at least for our first year, we are going to be extremely light with our tours, and we're going to have a very robust lineup in the fall. However, in the summer, we do have one tour. It is in Westchester. It's a tour in New Rochelle, focusing on Tudor revival style homes, which is, really flourishing there. It's a great, great representation of the architecture in that town.
Mm-hmm.
In Fairfield County in the fall, we have several that are being planned right now. We'll have a colonial themed tour in Ridgefield and a mid-century modern theme in Wilton. In the Westport area, we will have a tour that's focused on some really beautiful stone homes, all built by an architect, Fraser Peters, who is really prominent in the area, and he had a really unique, unique style. So that's going to be really great. We'll have a tour in the Milford West Haven area. The theme for that is still in development. We will have in September a tour in Fairfield, Connecticut, and we're going to look at a lot of different styles and of buildings on that tour, but they are all linked in the sense that they're all on the National Register of Historic Places.
Fantastic.
Because
that's
of
great.
Their architectural and historic significance.
Very good.
Yeah, so that one's going to be neat. You'll get to kind of get a nice sample from colonial to 20th century buildings.
Lots of surprises and certainly a one-of-a-kind exclusive experiences in store whenever you participate with History. You can learn more about them at histoury.org. History, learn about styles of architecture, community development, and the events and people that shaped the places that they go. Allison Casaza is a tour production manager for History. We hope that you'll take advantage of this interesting and relatively new nonprofit here in our region and learn more about the places we live. Thank you, Allison. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.